Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Faye Garland at the University of Manchester and Dr. Mitchell Travis from the University of Leeds. We're here to talk about their book today, Intersex Embodiment, Legal Frameworks Beyond Identity and Disorder. And it was published by Bristol University Press in 2023, so it's brand new. Faye and Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
It's my pleasure. Now, just to get us started, I'm wondering if you can first tell me a little bit about yourselves and how you came to write Intersex Embodiment, Legal Frameworks Beyond Identity and Disorder.
Gosh, there was a long lead-in to writing this book. So Mitch and I started working together, what, about 12 years ago? And while we were early career researchers at Exeter, we put together a module and Mitch invited a local intersex organisation and offered to give a presentation on issues affecting the intersex community. And from that, we put together a small grant funded by the SLSA. And then that tiny grant has just, I think, spiralled into something very big and quite nebulous. And we started to work on lots of different projects that we brought together under the book.
Yeah, so like you say, we started working together on the same day in 2011. We were at the same job interviews and we shared an office for the first 2 years. But then, yeah, the SLSA grant helped us to interview 16 intersex people throughout the world about their perspectives on law and intersex. And then it took us a long time to get that data out for various reasons. I think we had 3 children between getting that grant, not together, separately. getting the grant and publishing some of that data, and like Faye said, it's just run. When we were talking to intersex organizations before we wrote the grant, it felt like we had a lot to offer here in terms of our legal expertise. It seemed like that was missing from the conversation, and so we kind of figured that there would be like impact potential from this, but I think we've been surprised by how much that's been the case.
And again, also when we began, it was a real pivotal moment in terms of the way that law was beginning to engage with this area. So we really came at a time where we started to see a huge amount of legal reform. I think really from the moment we started writing the grant, it just seemed to like spiral. So a lot of what we've been doing has been, I guess, at the cutting edge of some of that legal reform, hasn't it? We've been tracing that impact and that story over the past sort of 10 years or so.
Yeah, I think we've ridden the wave, haven't we, of legal reform a little bit.
Yeah.
Been cool.
Yeah, but it's super interesting and really important work. Like, to be honest, before your book, I hadn't come across anything written about intersex. I don't know, maybe you want to tell me a little bit about the law and reform process and how you were part of that.
Do you think it's helpful to tell a little bit about what intersex is?
Yes, that would be great, actually.
Yeah.
So intersex variations are people who are born with chromosomal, hormonal, or genetic patterns that put them outside of the typical categories of male or female. So maybe or at the intersection of those two categories. They're congenital variation, so it's not an identity that you can become. It's something that happens within a person's body, you know, from when they're born. It's something they're born with. And then, but it's picked up at different stages. So sometimes it'll be picked up in at birth because there'll be atypical genital variations or sex characteristics, and they'll be picked up quite quickly. But then we speak to people regularly who find out in their, you know, mid to late 30s who want children, and they go to their doctors and they say, well, how come I'm trying. And the doctor says, well, you don't have a uterus, for example, you know. So that's kind of what intersex is, and that might be helpful in terms of grounding some of this stuff.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And so I know we're going to go into detail on this, but one of the key ideas that does come through in the book has been the role that medicine has played in identifying, cataloging and understanding the intersex experience. And I think that sort of picks up on what you just hinted at, that intersex can be picked up at all different stages through a person's life. But it does sound like there's, you know, real prominence in terms of medical diagnosis and expertise. So perhaps you can tell me a little bit about that.
There's a really long history of medical dominance in this area that sort of stems from the Victorian era. Particularly taking hold along with kind of medical advancements in diagnoses and the sorts of like surgical interventions and hormonal interventions that could be provided really in the mid 20th century. And accompanying that, there was work by Professor John Money on the way that gender identity develops that really entrenched this kind of medical understanding of intersex and this medical, I guess, regulation of intersex bodies. But the result of that has been a kind of social erasure of intersex in a variety of different capacities, you know, social erasure in terms of everyday understandings, but also an erasure from legislative frameworks as well. So there was legal recognition of intersex variations and intersex people, but as kind of medicine has really co-opted this and intervened in a variety of ways, we've just seen that sort of disappear from any form of sort of social legal consciousness.
Yeah, so I mean, it's worth thinking about that 19th century history of medicine in terms of Alice Drager talks about this in her book, but one of the things that medicine was trying to do was prevent same-sex relationships. That's what it was hot on. That's what it was trying to prevent. And that was where some of the impetus came to really regulate this sphere, but to do it through medicine. But the moral imperative was there. And also to ensure that there was correct gender relations, right? Because, you know, jobs and inheritance, all of these things at that time are dictated by gender. So the medical impetus to intervene in this area came from this really clear separation of sex and gender. And so it's funny then to watch that play out again and again and again through to where, like Faye's talking about medicine in the 50s with John Money and the John Hopkins Center in the US. Again, all of this is playing out over and over again, and to some extent still playing out now. I know the reason that Faye says there's an erasure there is because what happens from the 19th century, 20s, 30s, of the 20th century, people start to say, well, these people can be put into a true category of sex. We don't have a middle sex. We don't have an intersex. These people are male or female, and we can place them into the binary, and we can do that through medical intervention. And so that is where the erasure comes from, because when they're talking to parents in the 50s through to probably the 90s, maybe even a little bit later, and maybe now still actually, they're saying, your child is a boy or a girl, and they just need to be finished in these certain ways through these surgical procedures, and then they will be quote unquote normal. And so then you lose these people because they're fixed and they're kicked out of the, you know, the healthcare system, and you don't necessarily see them again. But they don't know they're intersex, or their parents don't know they're intersex. It wasn't explained to them in those terms. So that's why we've seen that really latent political consciousness and organizing around intersex, because like Faye said, they've been erased.
Can you tell me a little bit more about this political consciousness and the sort of politics surrounding intersex?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was waiting for Faye. So in the 1990s, we start to see this shift towards organizing around intersex in a real organized way, right? So you have Interact, I think there was it Interact? ISNA, sorry, the Intersex Society of North America in the US in the 1990s, organized around someone called Bola Runt, who sent a letter, I think, to Nature in response to something they published to say, we're organizing this thing. It might have been called Hermaphrodites with Attitude before that, but it went on to become ISNA. And a lot of consciousness was built around that. So people became involved with the movement through that, and they became involved through all over the world, right? So still at that point, they're using VHS and letters, maybe the early parts of the internet to start organizing. But that's when this people start to come together and they're like, this experience chimes with what has happened to me. I would like to be involved in that. But I mean, that's its own history. We don't touch upon that much in the book, but there tends to be quite a unitary picture of that. But that, I think in some senses, was also a little bit divisive amongst the community about how that was read, because they had really clear links with, we do speak about this in the book, really clear links with LGBT organizations, but were at the same time trying to maintain some semblance of a relationship with medical doctors. And I think they found treading that line quite difficult. Which is eventually what led to them finishing and becoming the Accord Alliance, which is quite a medical focus.
And then, so I'm really interested in the methodology used for your book, because it is such an unusual topic. And I mean, my assumption is that it would be really difficult to get access to the information, especially if there is a limit on sort of the way that people are organized. So maybe you can tell me about your methodologies.
So, it's a difficult area through which to conduct research. We used empirical methodology, and on a first project that was quite simple, really, in the sense that we were asking people to speak with us who were already outspoken and making speaking with politicians, coming out, making reports to media. So they were quite willing to engage in a public way and speak with researchers. With our study on Malta, which was a much more in-depth exploration into the impact of specific form of legislation, seeing and speaking to individuals with intersex traits is actually very difficult, and it was a considerable hurdle that we came across. There are multiple reasons that go into that, but essentially it's a very stigmatized area. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of not wanting to come out and speak to people and tell people your story. So I think it is a specific form of methodological challenge in any researcher trying to build knowledge and understanding in this area.
We had to swallow a lot of pride here as well. We talk about this in the book, actually, and it's a part that everyone seems to really resonate with, this journey that we went on. Because we were young, we were both of us kind of 2 years or a year out of our PhDs, new area, and we were looking at X markers, because that's what really was big at the time. So Australia had these X markers.
That was a political controversy, wasn't it? That was the political hot topic.
Yeah, Germany had just created this sort of blank space for children born intersex, and we were like, yeah, we've got this money from the Sociolegal Studies Association, and this is what we're going to study, and it's going to be so cool. So we went to the first couple of, we had this all signed off by a couple of intersex people in the UK, but we went to some activists, international activists worldwide, and said, would you mind participating in this study? It's going to be really great. And they were like, no. And we were like, oh, that's a bit of a shame. And they were like, yeah, how dare you come and speak to us about X markers when the real problems that our community face are around non-therapeutic surgical interventions? So how dare you frame this completely in this way? So we were like, oh, well, we could, you know, we thought that when we did the interviews that other things might come up, and we're not adverse to that. You know, we're really happy to that. And they said, no, by framing it in this way that you have around X markers, you're not focusing on the kind of topics that we want to prioritize. It's a really dangerous thing to do, and we won't speak to you. And that was a real shock to us. And I think we had to be a lot more humble than we were. We had to do a lot of learning. We had to go back to the drawing board. We had to go back to the SLSA and say, can we change the title and the focus of this?
Yeah.
And
there was a lot of self-reflection, I think. Self-reflection is a continual part of being a researcher, I think, but particularly in those early years, a lot of self-reflection about what we were trying to do with the project as well, because I think there's a tension between your role as a researcher and your employment as being a lecturer who also is under, you know, contractual obligations to get research out and things like that. And doing research with, or I guess when we started on really, a marginalized, very vulnerable community. And I think that we had to really think about our motivations behind that and be quite honest about it. And a lot of the work that we've produced has been through the support that we've had from intersex communities. I think there's been a lot of patient people with us who have actually taken time to really do the work of educating us and do that labour for free, essentially. And I think we're quite indebted to the people who've really called us out on some of the intellectual, like showboating, I guess, that researchers can fall into the trap of doing. So methodologically, I mean, increasingly, so Mitch and I have been putting together other grants and other projects, and, you know, that idea of this ethics of care, this idea of centering projects around the participants who you're working with has become increasingly important in the work that we're doing. So I guess that's really at the center of the way that we approach the things that we're doing now, about we try to do things in partnership for the benefit of the communities that we're working with.
I think that's right. And I think that moment is central from when we've moved from working like on a community to working with a community. And it has just completely shifted our praxis, the way we operate, the way we integrate things, the way that we will take our ideas to those communities and trial them out with them before we do the research. And but that pays dividends, right? Because we just had a book review from an activist and an academic who worked together at review. And they said, like, they see themselves in that research. It's empowering to them because it reflected the ideas that they wanted to see, and that they wanted to see spoken about. And then people come to us with new ideas and say, well, now you should look at this. And so the research has become kind of self-perpetuating in a way, because we are, you know, it's circular. We take the research back to those communities and say, look, I hope this is helpful to you in your struggle. You can take this to policymakers, and we can take it to policymakers. And they say, that is helpful. What do we do next? And we say, well, let's talk about it. So yeah, that's this research has been super fruitful, and we have published a lot now, and we'll continue to publish. We've got no plans to stop, have we? But yeah.
Sounds like a threat, Mitch.
No, but that's such a refreshing and humbling story. It's so interesting because, I mean, I think as academics, like, it's so easy to lose sight of the purpose of the work that we're doing, you know, actually getting it out of the ivory tower and empowering the people that you're working with, and actually having meaningful impact is, like, so important.
Yeah, and it's something that I see – what I would look for now if I was doing reviews, where people are like, I come from this kind of, like, not to dunk on any particular methodology, but like queer theoretical background, like intersex people, they rupture the kind of intellectual boundaries between male and female. And then I'd be like, well, if you actually speak to intersex people, quite a lot of them don't want to do that.
I think that that ivory tower-ness of, I mean, you know, there is, of course, importance in reflecting on those sorts of bigger questions, but the ivory tower nature, I think, of research has created a lot of mistrust from lots of different communities. And that certainly, particularly when we were starting out, that was certainly something that we came up against, this real kind of distrust of big, powerful institutions within which researchers are working. You know, so all of that also has an impact on the quality of research that you can produce. If you can't access individuals, speak with individuals because of this very apparent power dynamic, that is going to inevitably impact the quality of research that you produce. And so that that was part of our learning curve, and again, part of our, I guess, our broader methodology.
But I think it's funny as well, like talking about this stuff and looking back on it. This isn't about the book, really. It's about the whole journey. But I remember publishing this piece in 2018. It was the first piece out of the 2013 study. And we, you know, put it online and we were like, we're so pleased with this. And all of the participants that we spoke to didn't think that intersex should be equated with non-binary. They were just super clear on that. It's something that they didn't like. And of course, as soon as we put that out there, people started to contact me, particularly, I think, through social media to say, well, I'm intersex and I do identify as non-binary. So how dare you leave my experience out of your data? And we were like, we were looking for people. We were desperate to interview people like you. It would have been so great to be in contact. And that's again, about building your like rapport with the wider community when it's out there. And so the book, I think, reflects that a little bit more, where we're like, you know, we're not so down on that equation. It just doesn't always work. And particularly, it doesn't work in law, but still leaving open the idea that people can have that experience. Sorry, Faye.
I think also just being honest about the limitations of your own research as well. You know, we know a lot about law and law's understanding of intersex, but we certainly don't speak at all for intersex lived experience. And we're not by any means have any shape of expertise on what it actually means to live your life with intersex variations. But also, you know, gets you thinking about the importance of like how you frame your research, the importance of words, the importance of like titles. You know, sometimes the title doesn't feel weighty on research grants, but actually all of that sends out a message about how you understand a particular phenomenon and where you might align yourself. And I think, you know, I think we think very, very carefully now about the words we use. You know, we have a lot of discussion over what particular terminology we use because we don't want to alienate anyone, but yet we need some terminology to be able to express an idea.
And the book starts and ends there, right? Because we ummed and ahed over using the term intersex in the title because there's a couple of other contenders, right? So if you're coming from a medical standpoint, which both medical professionals, but also some intersex people are, they see themselves in this like medical framework. You might use the term disorders of sex development. You might use the slightly more open term differences of sex development, but DSDs. People who are coming from a more kind of LGBT background who don't identify necessarily with that medical pathologization, in part perhaps because of the mistrust of medical institutions themselves, might prefer the term intersex, or more recently, there's a term variations in sex characteristics, which is a lot more open, but perhaps hasn't got the salience at the academic level. Like if we publish a book called Variations of Sex Characteristics, which actually Lee May Lau has, and it's a great book, but will it get the kind of pickup in trade, I guess, of people who are like, I understand at least what that is a little bit, and so I will pick that up. So the book kind of starts there with, okay, well, these are the different terms that are in use and where do we sit with that and why are we using those different terms? But then it also ends with that, where we take you through these kind of epistemological framings, right, where different institutions, whether that's medicine or law or psychosocial care, set up intersex in different ways. And then intersex people see themselves through those lenses and experience their intersex variations through those lenses. And that doesn't mean, you know, like Faye says, we don't speak for those people lived experience. We can't talk to that, but it doesn't mean we can't criticize the epistemologies on which they're based, right? It doesn't mean that we can't say, well, actually these framings aren't helpful. And we end up like not necessarily privileging any of them, I think, but just trying to see them as like multiple, and how when you move into these different institutional spaces, you might talk in one register. Like if you're talking to your doctor, you might use the name of your intersex trait or your sex variation. But when you're talking about the kind of rights that you'd like to see from your government, you talk in terms of intersex because it's easier for them to understand. Like there's slippage between all of these terms.
Yeah, I really liked the nuances that came out in your book, that it doesn't, you know, the terms and the terminology doesn't feel really settled. And there's so much that can sort of be read into it. And as you say, from sort of different perspectives, from like a medical perspective, from a legal perspective, you know, from embodiment as well. Like that was really fascinating. I want to talk a little bit more about the terminology. The second chapter, medical embodiment, intersex as disorder. So can you tell me about disorder in this context? Because I think it's really interesting.
I mean, simply that... that medical terminology has been used to diagnose intersex variations, present them as a disease or disorder that is in need of fixing, and that can be fixed, and that there are certain types of interventions that can be, you know, like surgeries and hormonal therapies that can be used in order to fix it. Disease and disorder, those languages and those words and terminologies are usually the first way in which an individual encounters their intersex variations, you know, with medical professional talking about a disease, talking about a very specific type of diagnosis. And in some ways that can make it quite difficult in terms of mobilizing the community as well, because certain terminology that you might have over a particular diagnosis, an individual might not realize that is included within the intersex umbrella.
It's also really powerful to parents, right? So parents are going to be the first people who pick up on their child's intersex variation in lots of circumstances. And so if the doctor says, I can fix your child using these non-therapeutic surgical interventions and they will be normal and they won't be bullied and they will have a lovely normal life, parents are just, of course they would go down that route. They think it's in the best interest of their child, and so they are pressured into going along with these elective surgeries and consenting on their child's behalf. And so this disorder narrative, it just has such power in this context, because it is the first epistemology, right? The first institution that parents and children will come up against.
So we did a freedom of information request a few years back with a couple other scholars, and we found like the first meeting they have with the medical team is usually led by a pediatric urologist or a pediatric surgeon. So already you know that even, you know, how those discussions are going to be framed. And there's some psychological research, I can't remember the name of the author, Mitch, you're much better with names than I am, that showed actually if you frame something as medicalized, individuals are much more likely to select medical responses in order to cure it, so that, you know, it really has a profound impact on the shape of that individual's life going forward.
Yeah, Struly is the name of the author.
Struly.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine a doctor coming to you and sort of presenting that your child is inherently flawed in some way. For parents, like exactly your sort of knee-jerk response is, well, how do we fix this?
Yeah. And I mean, you think about like childbirth in particular, it's a traumatic time anyway. You've got no sleep, you know, there's other potential complications with the mother's body, and the dad's pretty freaked out anyway. When you add something like this into the mix, parents go through a kind of grieving process. That's how they describe it when you ask them.
That's where there's the importance of psychosocial of talking, you know, the importance of talking and supporting parents through the talking. And I think I mean, I think parents have a really interesting role here, because sometimes it's more complicated perhaps than just being led down this path of medical interventions. But, you know, we've had ad hoc discussions, haven't we, about medical professionals seeing parents and parents saying, I'm not taking my child home looking like that. So there is also this kind of emotional pressure. And I think we talk about this idea of a social emergency as well, that, you know, that medicine is involved with, which perhaps intensifies or increases the likelihood of talking about this as a disorder that needs fixing and needs fixing quickly to remedy this potentially broken family unit.
And that's, you know, this social emergency, right, stems from a culture that doesn't recognize a space between male and female. So when you say, and it just doesn't understand it, like we don't have the tools to discuss it. So the first question is still, is it a boy or a girl? Before we know the name, before we know anything, it's still this super gendered binary that parents are presented with, that just must place enormous pressure on them. Like we don't shy away from that. We feel for these parents, difficult situation.
So then I guess my next question, I think this is a theme that sort of comes through in the book. It's about Law's power to disrupt these sort of binaries and these categories. So perhaps you can comment on this a little bit. Like, what is the role of, like, what can Law do in this space?
I'm going to start this, and then you can answer properly. We did a international book launch, and two of the speakers were Sharon Preeves and Morgan Carpenter. Sharon Preeves is a sociologist at Hamline University in the US. Morgan Carpenter is a PhD student and now, I think, research assistant in Sydney University in their bioethics department, but he's also the chair of Intersex Human Rights Australia. And they both said that we gave Law not enough
credit.
We didn't give enough credit for what it could achieve, and that we were quite harsh on Law. And, you know, I think that might probably be the case, but I think it stems from coming from a Law background where we're just inherently critical of Law, I guess. That's what we're, as sociological scholars, I feel like that's what we're kind of trained to do, is to bash the Law.
Maybe we're grieving as well, Mitch. Maybe we've been taught as Law students that the Law is the answer to everything, and our whole career has been about how it's not really lived up to the expectations we had when we were 18, 19, 20. So we're really... We need to go into therapy with Law, I think.
Yeah,
but I mean, this study in Malta, I think, has been quite revealing in terms of thinking about the utility of Law. So when we wrote about Malta in the book, it was very early days. We only had a couple respondents at that point, but now we sort of completed the project and we've got a few more respondents. None of them are intersex for lots of different reasons. That we found that quite difficult finding Maltese intersex people. So the pinch of salt is our reflections here are from the attitudes of healthcare practitioners and policymakers. But so Malta introduced this amazing legislative reform, groundbreaking. It was like celebrated globally, celebrated within activist communities and academic communities. But when we actually started to do these interviews with policymakers and healthcare practitioners, who some of which were very closely involved with legal reform in Malta and further implementation, Law hasn't changed anything, it seems. There's more political consciousness, but there isn't a growing capacity or community of intersex people in Malta. There isn't greater cultural visibility. There is infighting, I think, over what is and what isn't intersex. So it doesn't seem to have changed medical practice as such. And so in that sense, at like kind of a micro state level, there are questions there about what Law can do on its own if it doesn't have the buy-in and support and resources from other different types of mechanisms that you need to get social change. But on the other hand, the Maltese legislation, as a result of that, we're now seeing across Europe, in particular Europe, but not just Europe. So like Kenya's got some law reform coming in. You know, we've got all of these different countries beginning to introduce legal prohibitions. And so on that like massive macro international scale, you know, it's actually had a really big impact on political consciousness and political visibility. So I think law can do something, but I'm reluctant or I'm not convinced by the extent to which it can change this area. You've got, you know, a century of very entrenched medical narrative here, medical responses, and a lack of resources to support. You don't have any like bottom-up support or resources going on. And I don't think law can really disrupt some of those binary assumptions without something else going on in a bigger sense across society.
So it's an interesting, I was just thinking then as you were talking about the type of research this is, right? So that, you know, in universities, like, we want challenge-led research. This is challenge-led research. We are led by the problems that the intersex community face, right? And that presents challenges, but it also presents opportunities for us as scholars, because I can't sit here and say, like, I'm a medical negligence lawyer. All that I do is look at medical negligence in this one or different context and tell you about medical negligence. If they need a criminal lawyer or a family lawyer or a medical lawyer, that is what we then have to offer, right? Because this we were constantly moving with the goals of these different communities. And so what I think now we're interested in, and this is, I guess, the point, is that we're shifting our focus towards the kind of afterlives of law or afterlives of legislation. So what are the effects culturally, legally, medically? And it's a shift in focus from, okay, right, now we've introduced legislation, well, what happens next? And that isn't something that we've necessarily done previously.
Yeah, it's sort of exploring the momentum of change post-law, isn't it? You know, and Malta's a very specific experience, and we're, 7, 8 years on? In the broad scheme of things, that's still not a massive amount of time, even though, you know, in terms of, like, tracing social change. But it's trying to think about how to keep that momentum going. And I think there's something about law. It takes so much energy to pass a piece of legislation, so much fighting to pass a piece of legislation. I think that legislation can sometimes bring an end to some of that political momentum and that political drive. That's perfectly relatable, isn't it? You finish a massive research project and then you've got to start thinking about, you know, your impact activities that you're being asked to do. And you're like, oh, I've done the project, I've done all the work. You know, so I think there's something there about what we do after law and the story after legislation and how we continue momentum.
I think that is part of it, is about having systems of accountability that are in place to make sure that those things are implemented effectively, that they do have the kind of desired social changes that you want to see. And I think that's what we've been dissatisfied with in Malta, that there hasn't been that kind of pressure on the government to deliver here, because they don't have a visible intersex organization that's kind of a national organization that's calling them out on this. They do have some really great LGBT organizations, but the research for us is shifting, and it's shifting now, but it, you know, keeps us interested. So in terms of what can law do, I think it can do stuff, but that process is slow. It's not it's not necessarily about just legislation. It's about tracing the effects post-legislation and keeping the pressure on afterwards, which maybe involves, you know, maybe it involves international law and NGOs and again, working in a slightly different register to ones that we're used to.
Yeah, and how it sparks off, like, public conversations. And I think in Malta, those public conversations haven't happened yet. So the passage of law, and, you know, we haven't had a test case, like, even in the UK, we haven't had a test case, but, you know, it's the media and it's the energy that surrounds those kind of, like, public mechanisms through which law is done. I think that really has the biggest impact on lived experience, or the biggest potential, I should say.
So then I guess my question is, reflecting on the sort of limits of change broadly from the legislative reform in Malta, are there any lessons we can sort of draw from this example that might be applicable more broadly to other jurisdictions?
You have to get medical buy-in, I think that is so, so essential that you have to turn medical professionals to your way of thinking about intersex people and about social change, make them see the worth of what you're talking about, because otherwise it seems that it's not that they'll find loopholes. It's in some instances, it's just that they don't think these types of human rights laws apply to them. Like they just don't speak to each other. The scale differences between international law and your average medical doctor just don't speak to one another. So having the buy-in of medical professionals as a, you know, professional organization through the sort of co-option of individuals, I think is really, really helpful to making this a success. It's not the only way, but I think it really helps speed up that process of change and success.
And I think Mitch's point there about medical buy-in. Medical buy-in is different from medical dominance in the process. It's getting people on board before change is implemented, because most of the stalling seems to come from where medical practitioners suddenly realize that they might be talking about their area of practice, but they just weren't aware of this. And so if there's a sense that change has happened and conversations haven't happened with the right people, I think you get a lot of pushback, but also a lot of hostility as well, medical practitioners are human beings. There's a lot of defensiveness that goes on in this area. Medical practitioners, I don't think, want to think that they're hurting and performing interventions that amount to torture and degrading I think there is a necessity to do that. And in Australia, I think it was in New South Wales, they've just introduced a piece of legislation which isn't perfect by any means. There's been a lot of compromise, but the conversation that Malta's having now happened before that piece of legislation was introduced, and you can really see the difference in what's been included in the act and what hasn't. And we're waiting to see what happens in Australia as a result of this bit of legislation. But I feel like medical pushback won't be the issue here. There'll be other issues, but you won't have that initial stalling before you can even get anything else done. So in Malta, they're having one or two, there are sort of one or two variations that are being disputed over whether or not they're intersex or not. As a result of that, everything else that they've agreed as intersex isn't benefiting from the legislation because it's entirely derailed the process. So working out what the derailment could be beforehand is really important to make sure you can get the rest in for everyone else, and then talk out the nuances and the grey areas and the really difficult conversations.
So sort of, I guess, my next question is blue sky thinking. If, we could design this ideal legislation, get sort of medical buy-in, cultural buy-in, social education campaigns, in an ideal world, should there be a third gender that recognises intersex? Or is that overly simplistic?
Maybe there's a couple of different ways to take that, right? So one way would be to say that if we had a category of gender that was non-binary, then lots of different people would take that up. Non-binary trans people might take that up, and some intersex people might take that up. But I think it's really important to note that not all intersex people would take that up. They would happily be male or female or intersex male or intersex female or whatever. But but I think we want to sort of decouple the idea of non-binary and intersex being synonymous, because they're not. It's just two categories that sometimes overlap. So if we introduce non-binary, that's fine, but it's not necessarily a goal of the intersex movement, but it might be for some individuals. So maybe. And then, could we then take that further and look at the work of people like Davina Cooper and Flora Renz to say, well, what happens if we get rid of the registration of sex and gender altogether? Like, what happens if we just take that off birth certificates? What happens if we take that off driving licenses and passports? Like, what work does it do there? And what does it signal if it isn't there? So, and their work on the future of legal gender is really, really interesting. A massive non-answer to the question, but I just think I don't know whether that would then, if we were kind of more comfortable with the idea that sex and gender doesn't really matter that much, at least from the point of view of the documentation of the state, then maybe that opens up a little bit more space for parents and children to have productive conversations with medical doctors and psychosocial therapists to say, maybe we could just leave it for a bit until the child is old enough to decide on their own gender identity. We don't have to touch anything surgically while we wait. And then when they're old enough to make sort of capacitous decisions here, then they can choose surgery or not based on their preferences.
I guess there is certainly a difference between adults and children. And I guess if you get to a point where gender categories aren't important at all, then I guess it doesn't really matter whether or not you would have a third optional. You know, it wouldn't necessarily have the dramatic implications that that it has now. But I feel slightly cynical in whether that's entirely possible. Definitely agree with Mitch that, you know, third gender markers should be available to intersex people in the way they should be available to everyone, that if you would like to use them, then use them and use it as a way to express your identity, but not to have it forced on you. But with children, I think you have to be really careful about how you categorize them, because if parents are afraid about what that categorization means, that's where you start to see responses that might not necessarily have that individual child's best interest at heart.
Let's talk about Germany, Faye. Germany.
So Germany, 2013, it brought in a law where you could have, you essentially had space on your birth certificate or your registration papers, where you, if you had an intersex child or their sex was ambiguous, you didn't have to put a marker down on it, since you can now put down a marker. There's dispute over space and form markers. But essentially what that led to was an outing of your child as being outside of the binary, and parents didn't want that for their children. And as a result, you saw an increase in people agreeing to surgeries, having surgeries so that their child could fall within the marker. So I think we have to be extra careful with children, extra careful with children, and thinking about how parents might respond to things and how that reflects broader attitudes to non-binary and LGBT and transphobia and homophobia. Because a lot of people who are fearful about their child being different stems from broader discrimination against what it means to be different.
I think that's right. So like, it's all very well for us to sit here and say stuff about third markers and how important they are. And I think that's right. And people are, you know, taking up that battle. Really great people are doing this work on this area. I don't think children should be at the forefront of that battle, the forefront of disrupting the gender binary, unless they, you know, if they want to. That's fine.
Yeah, my caveat is, of course, not to stop them from it, you know, as they express themselves, but that it shouldn't be the adults making that decision.
And it shouldn't be a mandatory category for intersex people, because I think that does place these kids in a really difficult position, and at the front of a gender war for which they did not consent to be part of.
But then what you need then, though, is you need malleability, right? So if you are picking a letter, you need to be able to change that as the child's body change. You know, the child undergoes significant physical development in those first few early years, but also again through puberty. They don't really know the exact way in which a body is going to develop. They can predict it, but they don't really know. So I think you need to have a system in place that also is able to change and allows that individual to really reflect who they are.
Just a bit of flexibility, which is what law is known for, right? That law loves flexibility and impermanence and indeterminacy. That's what it really does well at.
So then I guess my next question is, do you have any key takeaways from your book?
For me, I think so they're doing the projects, there's lots that you learn and lots that's revealed that you weren't expecting. So I've got a huge amount to say about Malta, huge amount that we learned from engaging with the activists. But I think in terms of writing the book, I think it really was that self-reflection. And my favourite chapter that we wrote was, I think it's chapter two or chapter three on non-binary and really critiquing academia's role in creating some of these myths around intersex. And I think that has been the biggest takeaway from the, I feel like that has really changed the way that we're approaching different sorts of research projects now. Like positionality is right at the starting point of when we're thinking about how to design a next project.
I really like about my own book. I really like the idea of contingency that's kind of built into the book. So if you are coming from or engaging with a particular institution, it will frame intersex in different ways, right? So medical frame it as disorder. If you come from this LGBT perspective, you identify it in this kind of like queer mode, non-binary, might take it in this non-binary lens as well. And I think I like that I like the idea of that being scalable and taking that to different projects where you could take a particular instance of embodiment and say, the way that this is read and understood is contingent on the type of institution that it's engaging with. That was kind of one of the starting points of the project. And I think we delivered that in a really nice and accessible way. And that's the thing. And I think that we take that into the next projects that we do, is the kind of the contingency of this.
Yeah, actually, that's something I learned from reading your book. I do think that contingency is really transferable. I mean, I was sort of reading it. I do work in disability and thinking about, you know, the different ways of embodiment, like from a medical perspective, from a legal perspective, and how this can change the way you do your research and the outputs of your research as well, and how you can work with communities.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about the way capacity would be read in different situations,
yes,
or by different
exactly.
institutions, and that a lot of the conflicts could be read through these different institutional gazes, I guess.
Anyway. Yeah. So I've taken up a lot of your time today, both of you. Just before you go, can you tell me, what are you working on now?
Are we allowed to say?
Oh, sorry.
So we are, from the Malta project, we're writing up a couple articles that really start to delve into what the findings mean in terms of law and social change. And we are looking to put together some grants that maybe use Malta as a little bit of a pilot project and think more broadly about how law is, how it's been able to disrupt medical narratives in this sphere.
Yeah, we've also just had a piece accepted in Feminist Legal Studies, which is about gender diverse children, but you know, trans children more often than not. And some of the stuff that's happened to them since Bell and Tavistock, but reading this case, Bell and Tavistock, through a temporal lens, which again is about contingency really, isn't it? And the way that we might understand these children's relationship with time and how that's read through different institutions.
And we came to that through our focus on intersex. So originally that article started off as like comparing intersex with gender diverse children and trying to unpick why we've got really different approaches in law, where one is seemingly pushing on surgeries and interventions when children can't consent, and the other seems to be pushing away from surgeries and interventions when you've got children who are and young adults who very clear on their sense of self, but then it ended up just being too big, so we leaned into the gender diversity aspect.
Yeah, but it's a nice piece, that one. I'm excited for that to come
from. Yeah, I'll definitely look forward to reading it, because I mean, as I say, I learned so much reading your book, all about obviously so much about intersex, which was something I didn't know about, but also these ideas about law and social change and how law can, or the limits of law in terms of disrupting medical narratives. You know, all the work you did on positionality, and that really comes through. And I do think it's a really transferable book for so many scholars.
That's nice to hear.
Thank you.
Yeah. So just to bring it to a close, I'm Jane Richards. I've been speaking with Dr. Faye Garland and Dr. Mitchell Travis, and their book is Intersex Embodiment, Legal Frameworks Beyond Identity and Disorder. Faye and Mitch, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us. That was lovely.
Oh, great.